part in this panel. It was as a respondent or discussant of the other papers. Through what is not entirely a coincidence, he's also going to take part in the papers. Last March, the Schoenberg Institute, the University of Southern California, held a conference on Schoenberg's Pure Lumière and Boulez's Marteau sans maître, commemorating, among other things, the 75th anniversary of the first performance of Pierrot. And both Andrew and I were asked to participate and talk about various aspects of Pierrot, which was one of Schoenberg's the most influential works of the early modern movement, and not incidentally in the present context, the only one of Schoenberg's works that he himself recorded. And Andrew has made a widely performed English translation of the text, and he talked about that in Los Angeles, and also about the general problems inherent in Sprechstimme and Schoenberg's sometimes contradictory descriptions of what he wanted. And he's kindly agreed to recapitulate some of that material for you to provide a context for my further discussion of a particular historical aspect of it. So here's Andrew Porter.
Well, to put that in another way, all I'm going to do is provide a very short preface to David's paper, not actually talking about the translation difficulties, I think, but really just trying to show that there is a problem in the performance of Pierrot Lunaire, and letting David show that by using recordings, we can get much closer, perhaps, to an answer to that question about the performance than people have been doing. Pierrot was a different task for me to translate because it's not a song cycle. The vocal line is written for what Schoenberg called Sprechstimme, speaking voice. And what exactly he meant by Sprechstimme is something that not he nor anyone else has ever been able to define with any precision. Pierrot was composed for the reciter Albertina Zehmer. And what she expected was probably a melodrama in the technical sense of that word, poetry recited to musical accompaniment. Schubert wrote a song for speaker and piano, Abschied von der Erde. Wagner set Gretchen's Prayer from Faust in that way. Liszt's Lenore was famous. And Richard Strauss, just before the time of Pierrot, had revived the genre with his Enoch Arden in 1897 and Das Schloss am Meer, 1899. Both of them for reciter and pianist. But what Albertina Zehmer got was not a work in which the vocal line was either free recitation or recitation with just the rhythm specified. What she got was a work in which the speech-song line is an integral part of the musical composition, sometimes notated in musical canon with the instruments, and in the final song, actually at times in unison with the piano. All the durations, as well as the pitches, are precisely indicated. On the other hand, it's not song, pure and simple. In a preface to the score, Schoenberg endeavors to define what he has in mind. The artist, he says, has the task of transforming the precisely indicated pitches into a Sprechmelodie, a speech melody. The artist must, he uses the masculine rather surprisingly, the artist must realize the rhythms with hairline precision, with no more freedom than he would use in a song. Some phrases which are marked to be sung must clearly be distinguished from the spoken parts, where the idea, and here I'm trying to translate what Schoenberg says, is to touch the written pitch and then glide either upward or downward from it. It must in no way resemble naturalistic, realistic speech. On the other hand, it must in no way resemble singing, nor must it sound like sing-song. That's a tall order, and over the years it's been very differently fulfilled. Roughly speaking, Pierrot interpreters have been divided into those who sing and then sustain the pitch of Schoenberg's written notes, those who pay very little attention to the exact written pitches, and those who come somewhere in between, sounding the written notes where they have an evident musical significance, but opting for freedom in the more melodramatic passages. The composer confused things himself from the start. In the sixth poem, Madonna, which is roughly an E, he writes a Sprechstimme E for the protagonist at bar 10 with an E major chord forming beneath it, and then adds the verbal instruction, very high, sehr hoch. Well, how high is very high? Higher than that written E, And to the ninth song, Pierre Tupiereau, he adds the footnote, the recitation must just hint at the pitches. It's significant, I think, that Prayer to Pierrot, which has this note, just hint at the pitches, was the first of the songs that Schoenberg composed. Well, in 1942, there appeared a recording of Pierrot, directed by Schoenberg himself, with Erika Stiedry Wagner as the reciter. She is very free with the pitch of the written notes. 20 years earlier, Schoenberg had already declared his preference for Stiedry Wagner's freely spoken performance against Maria Freund's more accurately pitched performance. In 1949, he said, Pierrot must just be spoken without fixed pitch. In 1927, Schoenberg's pupil Erwin Stein wrote in an article about Pierrot that these initial pitches just touched on were far too fleeting to play any significant harmonic role at all. But 20 years later, when Stein prepared performances of Pierrot in London with Hedley Anderson as the protagonist, he urged her to sound the written pitches precisely. She was the first Pierrot speaker, whatever you like to call it, I ever heard, Hedley Anderson. Schoenberg used Sprechstimme in other works, Die glückliche Hand, Gurre Lieder, and what he says about it there merely confuses the Pierrot matter further still. Alban Berg coached the first reciter in Gurre Lieder. And in a 1913 letter to Schoenberg, which is now here in the Library of Congress, Berg asked, is it enough to achieve the closest possible approximation to the pitch? Schoenberg replied that in Gurre Lieder, the pitch notation must certainly not be taken seriously, as in Pierrot Lunaire. Nearly 40 years later, he repeated this distinction in a letter to the Stiedrys. As against Pierrot, there are no pitches in Gurre Lieder, which can only mean that in Pierrot there are pitches. But against that, set that 1949 letter I mentioned, without fixed pitch, and Rudolf Kulisch, who plays in the Schoenberg recording of Pierrot, was apparently emphatic that the composer wanted the notated pitches to be avoided. Sorry, I've left a page behind. So, what is one to make of all this contradictory evidence? Well, Albertina Zehmer, the first interpreter, put things in a nutshell, but not very helpfully. She wrote a volume entitled in 1920, The Ground Rules for Artistic Speaking and Singing. She says, the reciter has to know how to find a speech melody that fits the music. My own feeling is this, that on March the 12th, 1912, when Schoenberg began the cycle, starting with that number 9, and wrote the footnote, just hint at the pitches, he had in mind something approaching heightened, rhythmical, and approximately pitched speech, such as we are going to be hearing from David Hamilton. But that as the composer progressed through the cycle, it occupied him for a period of just over 2 months, the vocal line became more and more a part of the musical texture, until in the last song, O Ancient Scent from Far Off Days or Fabled Times, it becomes that melody doubled by the piano. My own solution to this problem is not dogmatic, but empirical, pragmatic, as to most problems. See how it comes out in the wash. I'm going to play excerpts from 3 different recordings. One by Erika Stiedry Wagner strikes me as insufficiently melodious at times, despite the fact that she is Schoenberg's chosen interpreter. One by Ilona Steingruber, on the other hand, strikes me as at times too much sung. I don't have an ideal one to offer you. The third one will demonstrate the one approach that I'm sure is wrong, that kind of wailing or caterwauling that one sometimes hears, derived from Schoenberg's instructions to move upward or downward from the initial pitch that struck, the kind of fierce, triumphant, sweet and yearning, that kind of thing. We do use glide tones in speech, all the time, and they do cover an unexpectedly wide range. Phoneticians have been doing some interesting work on this. They've shown, for example, that the speaking voice may leap as much as a tenth when pronouncing a particular incredulous, really, or even the other way around, really. But what we don't use is long sustained slithery portamento. And I don't think a reciter of Pierrot should use it either, except maybe for one or two special effects. And with that except, I make my position clear. I favor a flexible, undogmatic interpretation, here approaching more closely to speech, there more closely to song, as the words and their setting and the various varied musical contexts and textures may suggest. Now let's listen to three interpretations. First, straight on end, the first 10 bars of the final song, O Alter Duft. In English, the words are, O ancient scent from fabled times, again, you captivate my senses. A merry troop of roguish pranks pervades the gentle air. First, Erika Stiedry Wagner, who is delicate and sensitive, and I particularly like the way she says, Schelmerein, roguish pranks. But on the word Märchenzeit, she extends Schoenberg's falling third into a much longer downward slide. Then there's Ilona Steingruber, who sounds the pitches and gives us the harmonies and defines the clear E major cadence in the third bar on Märchenzeit. And then there is a version in English by Cleo Lane, on which I'll forbear to comment. Seems to be music. Same three in a whole song, representing, really, everything has three poles of approach. It's the Passacaglia Nacht, and it's probably, the words are anyway, black gigantic butterflies have blotted out the shining sun. Like a sorcerer's sealed book, the horizon sleeps in silence. From the murky depths, forgotten scents arise, murder, memory. Black, gigantic butterflies have blotted out the shining sun. And from heaven toward the earth, sinking down on heavy pinions, all unseen descend the monsters to the hearts of men below here. Black, gigantic butterflies. First one is Erika Stiedry Wagner. I should have said that this song is a passacaglia, and therefore it does have harmonic significance, what the voice is doing. So now let's hear Ilona Steingruber, who cleanly defines the minor and major thirds that mark the vocal line of this song, and sounds the harmonies with the passacaglia bass. And finally, Cleo Lane, who on those final words, where the voice takes up the passacaglia theme, she turns those falling thirds into a single pair of reiterated notes, as it were, not da, da, ba, ba, but taking the same pitch over twice. In other words, she does give us pitches, and she gives us the wrong pitches. Translation. Schoenberg have had in mind in 1914. Over to David Hamilton.
Thank you, Andrew. I promise not to speak in Sprechstimme. So the sum of the records may have some contribution to that question. For my part in the conference at USC, I decided to look into what early recordings might be able to tell us about the relationship between speaking and singing at the time when Schoenberg composed Pierrot. At a 1974 Schoenberg Congress in Vienna, Friedrich Cerha, the Viennese composer and conductor best known for his completion of the third act of Baer's Lulu, presented a paper entitled On the Interpretation of the Sprechstimme in Pierrot Lunaire, and he included a few such recordings. Cerha was looking for clues about how to perform the voice part in the face of Schoenberg's troublesome and contradictory instructions. My basic purpose was really rather to try and recover some of the historical context within which Schoenberg might have considered Pierrot and its vocal part practical. That is, to look at the state of German theatrical speech shortly after the turn of the century. It strikes me, by the way, that some of you may know more about this than the people I was addressing at the musical historians at the Schoenberg Institute conference, since you may be aware of some of these recordings. Unfortunately, one area I had hoped to investigate proved to be impractical at this time because of the dearth of material in American sound archives, and that's turn-of-the-century German cabaret entertainment. The possible relevance of this is that Schoenberg worked with and admired some such performers, and that something of the cabaret hangs over Pierrot, even though Zehma, who commissioned the piece, was an actress rather than a cabaret artist. The German volume of Voices of the Past indicates that recordings were made by several performers who worked at the Überbrettl Cabaret, run by Ernst von Wolzogen in Berlin, where Schoenberg worked for a while in 1901. In fact, Wolzogen himself made two sides, though it's not clear whether these are songs or spoken monologues. And the same list includes recordings by Viennese cabaret performers, including those who worked at the Fledermaus Cabaret, which some of you saw the Vienna 1900 show in one of another of its manifestations, will be aware was very much part of the same artistic movement as Schoenberg himself. And though I've yet come across no mention of recordings by Zehma herself, it's not impossible that she might have made some, and it would surely be interesting to know something about her voice, its range, and her delivery. However, the Regler Deutsch Index didn't turn up any of these recordings, so that may have to be a subject for later research in European collections, though if any of you know collections of German and Viennese cabaret recordings from the turn of the century in this country, I'd be happy to know about it. Surprisingly, I also encountered a striking dearth of recordings by female performers. Although there are many listed, it's hard to find any. This may be true in Europe, too. Cerha didn't include any in his paper. But at any rate, there's enough in common between the German actors you'll hear and the delivery of, say, Sarah Bernhardt to suggest that the ladies deployed similar resources and techniques. A more fruitful starting point proved to be the romantic tradition of melodrama speech over music, which Andrew has already mentioned and cited some examples. The man is the one he's mentioned, Tennyson's Enoch Arden, set by Richard Strauss, is probably the most familiar, especially in America, in the recording by Claude Rains and Glenn Gould in English. If you've seen the score, you'll recall that the speaker's part has no musical notation. The words are just printed above the piano part, and in a few places, syllables intended to coincide with a downbeat are underlined and positioned right over the note. Let me play you a bit of Enoch Arden in a modern German recording. First, from near the beginning, where Strauss fastens his leitmotifs to the three characters. I'm not going to pass out texts or translations for any of these recordings, because I really want you to focus not on the meaning, but on the vocal music, so to speak, the pitches, dynamics, sustained sounds, if any, stressing of consonants. In this case, note the extent to which this speaker, from the 1950s, relies principally on dynamics to make his point, using a relatively limited range of pitches. Thank you. if you were to read, for example, the New Grove article on melodrama, you'll read a great deal about the musical part of melodrama, and really not a word about the delivery of the speech, and you might, having heard recordings like this, assume that this is the way it was done. Next to Strauss, the most noted composer of melodramas at the turn of the century was Max von Schillings, whose 1911 work, Jung Olaf, Opus 28, with orchestral or piano accompaniment, is also dedicated to Ernst von Posart, the dedicatee of Enoch Arden. Schilling's most successful work in this genre was the earlier Das Hexenlied, Opus 15, published in 1904, also in alternate versions for piano or orchestral accompaniment. It must have been widely performed, for it appeared in English, French, and Russian translations, as well as the original German. Das Hexenlied is a setting of a poem by one Ernst von Wildenbuch about a dying monk who recalls his early initiation into the delights and terrors of carnal passion, that familiar fin de siècle brew of sanctity and sex. It was dedicated to the actor-singer Ludwig Wüllner, who was born in 1858, died in 1938, son of Franz Wüllner, the conductor who led the unauthorized Munich premieres of Wagner's Rheingold and Walküre. Ludwig Wüllner acted with the famous Meiningen Company in the 1890s and later with Max Reinhardt's Deutsche Theater and the Vienna Burgtheater, and also gave Lieder recitals. But he specialized in recitation, and he made two recordings of Das Hexenlied, the first an acoustic made in the early 1920s with an anonymous orchestra, probably conducted by von Schillings. The second is from 1933 with the Berlin Philharmonic under the composer, and it's probably the most remarkable surviving document in sound of the melodrama tradition, despite or perhaps because of the fact that Wüllner was by then about 75 years old. I was able to hear part of the first recording, incidentally. The interpretation is virtually identical, suggesting that it was formed before the microphone came along and didn't substantially change thereafter. As it happened, I heard the recording of Das Hexenlied before I had the chance to look at a score. Here's the end of the orchestral introduction and the first vocal entry. On hearing that, your first reaction might be the same as mine was, to suppose that this vocal part might have been notated rather precisely. Compared to our Enoch Arden example, this certainly sounds like a musician placing his voice on pitches as much as an actor just reciting. However, the score of Das Hexenlied turned out to be no more pitch specific than that of Enoch Arden. Occasionally, von Schillings will put staffless notes above a bar full of words to indicate a rhythm or put a parenthetical rest among the words to keep the speaker off a downbeat in the piano or orchestra. Be that as it may, the recording certainly suggests that Vilner has some sort of pitched score in his head, if not on his music stand. Indeed, it could easily be regarded as an example of what Zehmer recommended, as Andrew quoted earlier, finding a speech melody that fits the music in that passage where the music comes along. You may want to remind me that Vilner was a professional leader singer as well as an actor. To that, I would reply, first, that the speaker of the Ina Garten recording we heard is in fact a full-time singer of Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau, and he uses far fewer resources of pitching in his spoken performance, in fact delivering much of the unaccompanied poetry in the Ina Garten piece in the only slightly inflected monotone we're used to hearing from radio newscasters. When I was preparing my paper, Will reminded me that Fischer-Dieskau has written of being impressed as a boy by a Vilner performance, though he certainly doesn't deliver the text in anything like the same style. Secondly, if we turn to full-time actors from the time of Pierrot, we discover that Vilner's speaking technique was in no way exceptional. I have three examples, all from the mainstream of the German-speaking theater tradition. The first is Adolf von Sonnenthal, 1834 to 1909, who made his debut at the Burgtheater in Vienna in 1856, and is said to have been one of the most popular actors of his time. He was probably about 70 when he recorded this speech of Wallenstein from scene 18 of Schiller's Wallenstein's Tod. And I call your attention particularly to a descending phrase just before the recording ends. I've broken off because the tail end of it is badly worn. And Sonnenthal is clearly just as pitch conscious as Vilner. That's a recording from 1903-1904 for the Gramophone Company. Now here is Antoine Posart, the aforementioned dedicatee of Ina Garten, born in 1841, died in 1921, in parts from Schiller's ballade Die Bürgschaft, which some of you may know from Schubert's setting. In the opening, which features the conversational exchanges and ventriloquial effects often common in ballads, notice the cadential effect at Wenn Sie bestricken, die Frist. A bit further on in the description of Myros, the hero's return to Syracuse and the obstacles he encounters, Posart adopts an agitato rhythm and tempo and shapes a sort of speech melody. I might mention parenthetically that, of course, the playing speed of these recordings, except for the Vilner, which has music and which we have a score to pitch it by, is somewhat problematic. These are all transferred at 78, and I suspect in this case it's too fast.
Okay.
There's an... actually, if you can skip about a minute ahead, we'll save some time here as we're running along. Over the course of the whole ballad, Posart employs a range of an octave and a fifth, and at the end, with the there's a rescue opera sort of climax, and he returns to the tones and colors of the opening. You'll try it there and see where we are. Well, this is the resolution. From a later generation comes Alexander Moissy, born in 1880, died in 1935, who from 1906 worked with Reinhardt's company in Berlin, and in the 20s at Salzburg, starred in Hofmannsthal's Jedermann. His most famous recording is Goethe's Erlkönig, but since that ballade is so dependent on the impersonation of three characters in three distinct pitch ranges, I thought it would be more convincing to hear him in a poem with only a single persona, so to speak, to show that his use of a wide pitch range was not the result of some special circumstance. This recording of Goethe's Prometheus, a poem that vocal collectors will know from Hugo Wolf's setting, was made in Berlin around 1911. Cherhan noted some typical modern ranges, a major second to a minor third for newscasts, around a fifth or a sixth for what he called Gesellschaftskomödie, which I suppose is drawing room comedy, and for classical verse, a maximum of a seventh, whereas Moissy can be found to exceed an octave and a fifth. My recent informal observations confirm this. Among English-speaking actors, John Gielgud is one of the few surviving to use a range of as much as an octave. And even in his prime, I gather he was often referred to disapprovingly as something of a singer. In contemporary American culture, I think you find ranges like this mostly in Crazy Eddie commercials and burlesque situation comedy. So I think what these recordings suggest is
that the Sprechstimme of Pierrot was not an eccentric aberration, but rather an extension of existing practice. At least it started out to be that. The main difference was that instead of finding the speech melody in the words, as Zehmer recommended, the speaker was expected to go along with the speech melody that Schoenberg had already found. And there was a further complication. In the course of composing the work, Schoenberg went well beyond the pitch range of even an Alexander Moisey. The final written range of Pierrot is a good deal more than an octave and a fifth, and is simply impractical for a single speaking voice. I suspect he realized this pretty early on in the performance history of the work and came to accept vocal performances such as Stiedry Wagner's in a style that at least corresponded to his conception of the work's expressivity. Although the emotional signals that her delivery sends to modern listeners, I think, are very different from those she sent to Schoenberg and his contemporaries due to the altered nature of theatrical and, in some sense, everyday speech since then. We're dealing with a not unique phenomenon, I think, a musical setting of text modeled on a style of speech that is now defunct in general usage, at least in a serious context. An actor today who carried on like Moisey would be assumed to be engaging in parody or some kind of alienating stylization. This development is due in part to the normal course of stylistic change, but also, I think, surely to the spread of electrical amplification, which has effectively washed away the 19th century's tradition of public speech, patriotic, political, religious, and theatrical. In addressing great crowds, when dynamic variation is pretty well precluded by the need to project continuously at a fairly high level, pitch variation must have been the speaker's primary resource. Even in enclosed theaters, where more dynamic variety was obviously possible, pitch remained a central resource. Public and theatrical speech belonged to the same continuum. And I think, as these recordings show, so to an extent did singing belong to the same continuum. Another complementary example might be the fact that the tradition of public and theatrical speech is a strong presence in the declamatory writing of Italian Verismo opera. Consider the protagonist in Andrea Chenier. Two of his three arias are, in fact, as it were, on the stage, public orations, the improviso in Act One and the speech to the courtroom in Act Three. Singers up to World War II, Pertile, Gigli, La Rivolpi, even Delmonico, were familiar with that real-life background tradition of speech, the public speech. They work their interpretations out primarily from the notes, and they lose that tension, or they never encounter it. But then today's audiences don't know that tradition of oratory either, and the frenzied declamation of a Pertile would probably now be found absurdly exaggerated, or in what the critics often call bad taste. To the extent that the musical interest of that school of opera resides in such an oratorical style, and I think that's fair to say of some of the works, they may not outlive the withering of that model in life. If performed without that kind of panache, they're boring. And if performed with it, they seem ludicrous to most people. Since Pierrot, unlike some of those Verismo operas, retains its enormous musical fascination, intelligent singers have continued to invent ways to perform the Sprechstimme, which I think each generation will have to resolve afresh in some terms that jive with contemporary modes of expressivity and speech and singing. It certainly played an important role in breaking the stranglehold of the bel canto model of singing on Western European art music. A whole school of writing for the voice, Berio and Maxwell Davies are some of the modern contemporary examples, derived certainly from this work, very specifically. In this sense, perhaps the ambiguity resulting from Schoenberg's multiple instructions for performance may be counted a blessing, since having, as Will said earlier, foreclosed all options, he in effect leaves them all open. And at least the recordings I've played do suggest that Schoenberg's prohibition of singing in Sprechstimme may not have been intended to preclude a vocal style that, to us, may seem closer to singing than to speaking. If the basic approach that these records embody may not any longer be a feasible route to performing Pierrot, I think I would still urge anyone undertaking Sprechstimme to hear them. These were actors of great accomplishment with an intimate knowledge of the resources of German diction, and the expressive potential of their armory of rhetorical devices may be worth tapping, even if a wholesale embrace of their style would probably engender inappropriate responses in modern audiences. Thank you.
How are we doing? How are we doing on time?
4 minutes. Since Andrew is here as the discussant, I'd like him to discuss briefly. I guess you can get back.
I see that. Oh, we're fine.
This one's live. Just like,
two questions coming. Oh, I'll put everything in a sentence. I've just sent to press a new collection of New Yorker reviews. The preface to it is a rewriting of what I said at our last year's meeting, that recordings are increasingly important for critics, for performing artists, for musicologists, for the ordinary listener who wants to be an informed listener. I think this has been so amply demonstrated, I need to say no more than that, that it's fuller. And I just said they become more important today also for two reasons, three reasons perhaps, that the recordings are becoming more readily available, more carefully catalogued in archives. There are more reissues of them, and perhaps most important on this level, that we are discovering ways of getting more information out of more musical information out of what people once thought were scratchy old grooves, lifting up far more than was guessed was there only a few years before. There are three people who want to speak. This is one of them, I know, and two there. All right, let's Joe.
On the point of information, Paul probably knows that Massey and Gielgud and one other were all performing Hamlet in the mid-30s in London.
I didn't know Massey first.
Can I just add to that, as to authenticity of performance, since poets are not necessarily the best speakers of their own verse, is it not the case that perhaps composers are not the best performers of their own work? And I quote Wedderburn, composer scale, Roger Quilter, accompanying his own songs with those terrible spread chords, which have never subsequently been used.
Those lovely spread chords.
Get up the room to be heard. This is also in the nature of a point of information, which I think will interest some of you. The older theatrical traditions have been rather well preserved in Denmark in particular, just as in the older balletic tradition. And there are some rather interesting records put out by the Danish Tono label of Grieg melodrama, specifically, of course, the setting of Dernstein's Berlioz. There are two modern recordings of it, but you should hear it, and you can hear it at Rodgers and Hammerstein, I'm sure. This work done by the old-time Danish actress Augusta Bloch. And as they say, this is the real McCoy. Also, there is a recording from the same age of actors in the Danish theater, and I've forgotten who they are, but they were the best of their day, of Oslo's Death from Peer Gynt. And then there is a slightly later recording, that Mercury put out. And oddly enough, this episode is not on the complete Peer Gynt recording of Peer Gynt, and that is Peer Gynt and the Seder Girls, with Peer doing the speaking. For the moment, I've forgotten the name of the actor, but he clearly used the old tradition. But this is a good source for this kind of thing.
This question may be from left field, or from east field, perhaps. Is there any, we know the influence of Japanese art on European art of the late 19th and early 20th century. Is there any possible influence of recordings of Noh or Kabuki that came through Europe at that time? I've heard recordings, Japanese recordings, of the early 20th century of the mixture of Oriental and Western band music, for example. Is there any possible influence of pitch coming from that recorded material?
Well, it's certainly not impossible. If there were such recordings, I honestly don't know. Whether Guy's bird used
It also seems to be unlikely in a way that the recordings we've heard are people whose vocal styles were formed well before then.
Before
there was any possibility of such things.
Just to answer Richard's question briefly, Steve Simoleon has made some very interesting studies of the origins of Latin butterfly, and there seems to be some fairly clear evidence that he had early Japanese recording of a certain model of the composition. My own question, and it isn't deliberately naive, but you're welcome to laugh if you'd like, was perhaps the end of this highly declamatory, many octave acting interpretive pattern, perhaps the speeches of Adolf Hitler, which seem to me to embody a lot of what I hear, and that the whole element of rage aside, and was something the entire Western world wanted to turn away from after our experience with it.
I did think of that the other day when I and of course, he was on the radio. He used a microphone, but he was obviously using a speech technique more for that.
Well, I have one thought on that, if I may. Within my short lifetime, I have observed this wide range tradition fall into disuse in Southern preaching. Because microphones have come into pulpits in the South within the past two decades. And I can easily remember hearing very wide-ranging speech that I can't say that I am in church every Sunday nowadays to check on the latest progress, but I can certainly observe a difference, and I go down to the South to visit my family every once in a while, and I hear sermons now and then, and it really has changed. I think it has much more to do with the amplification.
I'm afraid that is all there is time for. I want to thank my distinguished colleagues for coming and joining us.